success would be to walk into a village in the middle of nowhere and that there are children there in multiple aged in a grandma's hut or whatever that are all recipients of like the world's best education.
Welcome to the EdTech Founders Podcast from EdTech Garage. In this podcast, we interview passionate founders and key players supporting early stage EdTech founders from across Europe. Hello, folks. I'm Frank Albert Coates, the founder of EdTech Garage. And we're back with episode 6 in our third season of the EdTech Founders Podcast. Today, I'm talking with Noam Gerstein, the CEO of the Bina School, a fully online primary transnational school for kids aged 4 to 12. Noam started university at 16 in Tel Aviv. She worked for Physicians for Human Rights. And then she founded, bootstrapped, and exited a business at 26. Then she did more than 7 years of global K-6 research that culminated in the Bina School. We are going to talk about the need to solve serious problems as an entrepreneur and not small consumer problems of discomfort, how building a school takes time, effort, and careful adjustment, how entrepreneurship is like eating dirt for a long time, why getting a white male in the room helps for funding, and lots more. Stay tuned for the interview. Hello, everyone. So we're back with a new episode in the EdTech Founders Podcast. And today we have Noam Gerstein with us from the Bina School. Hi, Noam.
Hi, how are you doing? Good to be here and good to see you.
Yeah, I'm well. And we connected a few weeks ago in London, actually. And when I saw you, I was like, yes, this is our next guest on the podcast. And you were delighted, right?
Of course. just let me talk.
Yeah. So let's dive into it. If you can just start for us, and the listeners, to give us a quick 30-second elevator pitch about the Bina School.
Yeah, for sure. So Bina is a global, mobile, whole primary experience that fits families everywhere. We create quality educational outcomes and joy at scale. So what we're doing is we fully educate kids aged 4 to 12 digitally and cross-geographically. We're shaping new ways to educate GNAs through pioneering what we call precision education. Basically, we offer small classes of up to 7 students led by top-tier teachers. The tech-based methodology and curriculum emphasize environmental, cultural, and social-emotional learning. Our students, primarily non-native English speakers, but we have some of both, kind of exceed the UK and US national averages, ranking in the top 8th percentile academically after just 1 year with us. We're pre-seed, but post-revenue startup. We have super wonderful people backing us up. We're being incredibly lucky that way. And we have phenomenal advisors, including like the UK's former Minister of Education, Jim Narayat, and Jamie Beaumont, just Marvel and other delights. Yeah, that's what we do.
Brilliant. Thank you for that. Lots to grab a hold of and talk about. But before that, tell us why Bina and why did you move into education in the first place?
So I can tell you like a 2-minute story. I'm in Jerusalem originally. I started university really, really early and worked with Physicians for Human Rights and did that for a while, which was wonderful and horrifying. We worked a little bit with detainees and prisoners are working in an open clinic, kind of no questions asked, no bills, then the vet will take care of you no matter what. Was part of the team that opened it and did some philanthropic fundraising for it. Worked daily in the clinic for, lived in London for a little bit, came back to Israel, opened the first business, sold it, and found myself surprised. And I mean, kind of a notion of privilege in two ways. One, I lived comfortably in a young age. That's a huge privilege in the world. And the second, I can build things. I can convince people to do things together. That's a huge privilege. And I think like every privilege, it's a responsibility. They don't come separately, these two. And so I thought the next thing I want to build is definitely something that people absolutely need, because other people can do the rest. It's fine. I do think that like serious entrepreneurship these days really needs to tackle the problems that we have, because we don't lack them. I'm not talking about small consumer problems of discomfort. And then our fascination with business models and huge industries. And the fact, I think that the corners of society that innovation is most needed and possible are the ones that when you look at the business models, you kind of go, wait, what? Why? Right. And I think in schooling is a really, really interesting one. It's a unique niche within the ed space, and just in terms of both like the size of the market and the amount of money that is poured into it, and also kind of the economic component of it, which I think is very different than when we start looking at, let's say, field-specific solutions. So got really interested in that. Then spent 6 years living nomadically, living in schools, and luckily interviewing little humans and their adults to see what works for them and what doesn't, and why. And the aim was to try and understand more about the differences and the similarities between the systems globally, and to think about maybe if we could potentially build a system upgrade, given schooling is shockingly similar, actually, in most places in the world. But what we imagine was as a school, when we say that word in different languages, is relatively similar, which is shocking and amazing, because there are not a lot of systems that are so, I mean, of course, there are modifications and alterations and people took it differently, yes, but the basics are similar, and it's because it was an incredibly effective way to move humanity from illiteracy to literacy, and that's like amazing systemic design. We love that. But it was built for a very specific set of resources and needs, and we have a very different set of resources and needs right now. So how can we kind of craft something that looks at, again, like a system that fits cross-geographically, that utilizes the resources for the needs of society and young families today?
Absolutely. And I guess the question then is, so why this format? So you're talking about the traditional system and giving it a systems upgrade. So most kids in the world, they go to a physical school, right? And then mm-hmm. came COVID. Okay, they had to change to virtual. But why an online-only school? And like, what's the advantages and, I guess, disadvantages of that?
Mm-hmm. Conceiving the idea of a cross-geographical daily life for little humans and educators and families came before COVID. And also in like online schools, like the old school of online schools have been around for almost 30 years by now. So it's nothing particularly new there. If we consider very high quality at scale, it is absolutely impossible to do in any other way. And this is before I even start talking about the things that we're starting to be able to do right now, which is creating unfathomable worlds for learning. There are just a lot of things you absolutely can't do in a physical space. For example, when we teach digitally, we can create assessment that is not periodic, but is on a continuum. So every time we play, we understand in a deep manner what people know, what they can do, and to which depth. And that's all the people within the system, both the students, the educators, families. And then we can craft on a real-time, valuable, and quick pace how to help them, how to support them, and what will be the most fitting. We can look at beyond right, wrong, and how long, which in traditional schools, you know, we can have a finger in the wind for. We can look at finger rhythms, concentration skills, and other things. And then obviously there are like aspects of management. And most moving to me, at least, it's resource allocation. So basically, traditional schools, like the two biggest buckets of resources are like real estate and infrastructure, right? Tables, chairs, buildings, and teachers' time. We come and say, okay, we are not spending money on infrastructure. Amazing. Because infrastructure exists. And I mean, again, like I don't really understand anything about teenagers, and I'm not going to assume that. So I'm literally only talking about the soft little people before they hit puberty. And then their emotional needs require like calmer environments that are warmer and smaller, not like half day jails of 2,000 people. We have enough understanding of why this is problematic by now. So A, we can avoid those costs and craft intimate physical environments. So that's awesome. But not only intimate physical environments, we can keep classrooms and groups incredibly small. And that's a big aspect of high quality learning. And we can do that at scale. And that's definitely not available at scale right now. So basically, the second big bucket is teachers' time. And on average, an educator spends 32% of their time with students and the rest of their time doing stuff, all kinds of stuff, like picking gum out of their hair and marking grades and building unit plans and sitting in meetings and walking in halls, just stuff. My educators spend the vast majority of their time with students, which allows us to keep classes with 7 kids or less and still have a very viable business model. That's unique and amazing. And obviously, like, we think about creating learning on a continuum, but we can do things that are learning on a continuum, not only for the kids. And that's the last very, very exciting thing. Let's say I'm an educator and I'm doing what I'm doing right now, which is talking for 10 minutes straight. So no one should be allowed to do that under no circumstances, ever. Never. If they're talking to humans, please no, don't do it. If they're talking to trees, I assume the trees feel the same, by the way. So the system can come here and say, hey, how about the next activity event? Like, just make sure that everyone's awake. So we can actually start implementing, and that's kind of bridging the huge gap between what we have and like learning sciences and what we see in classrooms, and kind of bridging that gap in a very active, proactive way, and renew that according to latest research on the continuum. So those are the things, some of the things. And then again, like if we're talking about an elephant, it should walk in the room, and that's possible now. The last really cool, really small for an incredibly divided world. When kids go to a local school, they meet their local peers. And the educators that are available to them are the ones that are in their neighborhood, more or less. In Bina, children can learn with children from the very north to the very south of their time zone. They are matched according to their needs, not according to their location. Mm-hmm. Also to their educators, by the way. And then we see wonders, like two kids from very different sides of the aisle or of the wall or of the war, learning together every day and becoming best friends. And that's marvelous.
So what sort of the audience you're targeting? And I would say like maybe the geo focus then as well.
So let's start with this, the easy. Number one, I mean, they're both kind of easy. So We now have Euro-African classes, what we call the Eastern time zone. So basically from the very north of Eastern Canada throughout South America, because, you know, most of South America is on the East time zone. We are opening PT, like the West Americas, in Q3 and East Asia in Q4. So that's exciting. But that's kind of the geos. The aim is to have eventually classes running 24/7 so families can join us whenever, wherever they are, and that we actually move with them if they're moving. Which brings me to the second point. We see, well, we expected to see early adopters of like three groups, and we actually see four, where the fourth group is surprising and really cool. So the first three are, one, we call them multi-cookies. So we have families that their life setting involves more than one culture. So either the adults in the family are from different cultures, or they are from originate from one culture and live in another area. We see the range from global trotters to refugees and everything in between. So people that move very frequently or not very frequently, like every 2 years either, then what they seek is stable international schooling. And usually they can get either or. That's the first group. The second group are people that live in what we call educational deserts. For example, for like all the, for real examples from the school from this morning, we live in Canada, rurally, in like the wonders of the snow and 3 hours away from the next school. We live on a boat. We live where they don't educate girls. We live where there's only Jewish education around us, and that's really awkward for us. So people that cannot, that they don't, in their local offerings, there is no option for them that kind of sort of makes sense. The third group is families that have unique situations, right? So for example, a grandma that is taking care of her grandchild and is not very mobile, cannot get him to school. Families that live in situations with extreme violence around them and are afraid to send their kids to school. That's very, very common, especially these days. There are a lot of neurodiverse cases that we do just beautifully with. So for all the kids that the idea of sitting for the entire day is not a great, is not too great for them. Like, we're here. And we designed for that. Those are the three groups that we expect. But potentially the biggest group are just young parents. That's it. And we don't really, like, there is a, that are looking at schools, like really young millennials or the older Gen Zs with young kids right now, looking at schools going like, I've been there. I've done that. No. Like, just no. No, thank you. None of it. No piece of this experience is what I want for my baby. Like, not the kicking anyone out of bed at 7 a.m., not the 2.5 hours in traffic, not the half-day jail, not the people screaming at my kids, not the content, none of it. Like, not for my baby under no circumstances. And that's common. Not a lot of institutions do, like, four-year-olds sure. And primary. We really specialize in experiences for the little ones. And I think what's very unique about Bina is that we do like the accountability and the responsibility for the kids learn, like formal learning is on us. Like, we are synchronous. We work together. We believe in groups. Kids are like engaged. All our families work. It's not at all the responsibility of the families to teach the kid. That's our job.
Okay.
And that's a huge difference, actually.
So yeah. Let's move on to more sort of some investor questions, perhaps. Could you share any metrics or any financials? Like, how's the business going? How easy is it to run a school, like an online school for these kids?
We did a lot of testing and groundwork, and it was very deliberate. So we wanted to make sure that we are accredited. Like, the beta ran for over a year. And even towards the beta, we did some, like, there was a year running up of, like, experiments and shorter classes. So actually, like, I'm going to give you the most non-bro answer. But basically, like, we are deliberately slow with some of the aspects of building. Because I'm like, here's a cool game, why don't you try it? Okay, it crashes, never mind. Because we offer, like, comprehensive education, like, we can't really morally do a very bad job, if you know what I mean. It's just not okay. So, you know, the idea of moving fast and breaking things as far as it applies to, like, our work, I would claim most work, but that's a different conversation. You know, when we move fast and break things, then everyone's broken, and that's not a good idea. So we spend a long time beta. We actually really open to, like, a growing stage in Q4, and obviously we are, like, nicely exploring right now, so that's cool. I mean, we're taking in whatever we can, and demand is super high, so that's exciting. You know, we're at 30 MRR right now. We have a model that has for three fully paying students, we have one student that's on some form of financial aid.
Okay.
So our average discount rates is still dropping, but the aim is to actually maintain a chunk of it and make sure that we support families that really need our work.
Okay. And how do you get that support for students who can't afford it?
It's baked in the model that there are students that are at cost. Because while fundraising, I actually had quite a bit of suggestions from people to take nonprofit money to support these kids.
Exactly.
But we're tiny, we're a startup. I don't have time to operate a nonprofit. That's not a thing. So I'm looking to collaborate with nonprofits that do that, and they kind of channel that funding for those families. There are other really cool ways to do that. Like, for example, in some states in southern U.S., the state fund chips in, let's call it, for families. So there are different ways.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so over a bit more to, you know, your success factors. So what will make you succeed, and what's your secret sauce for making it all work?
Like, if I'm blunt, like, I can't avoid being. Like, there are so many ways this could go wrong, like everything, but this one in particular, because it's very squishy. The crafting and weaving it in requires incredible amount of deliberation and carefulness, and that is in every aspect of what we do. So, like, a bad hire is very bad. Okay, like, mistakes in the product are, like, are painful. I have a very good friend that is building in similar spaces that when I was very worried about, like, opening, and he says, oh, come on, stop being such a female founder. It's horrible. Just start. And I'm like, I don't know, but what if we don't do it? He's like, I'm looking at my children and they're literally eating sand right now. They are eating sand right now.
Get this school started.
Whatever you give them is going to be better. but still, like, we're crafting this highly tailored system, which has multiple faces to it. So making sure that the best minds work on it, making sure that, like, our educators are of the highest quality, that we gain the right insights, that we learn, that we listen, obviously growing and understanding how to communicate ourselves and, like, how to build a voice that's coherent and relevant and constantly evolving, how to build experiences that are amazing, right? Like, how do we make sure in the world that we're talking about, right? And then how to make sure that, as you know, our generation we were not educated to educate this way. So, like, how do we also think about what type of support network we provide for the support network? So, like, how do we make sure that, like, families always understand what their kids are doing and always understand how to support them and feel emotionally supported and part of a global community? So there are a lot of moving pieces there. I think, you know, success would be end game, right? To walk into a village in the middle of nowhere and that there are children there in multiple aged in a grandma's hut or whatever that are all recipients of like the world's best education. But the dream, right?
So you mentioned some challenges, and what has been your biggest challenge since you started the company, and how did you solve it?
Funding was hard until recently, where it became less hard, both because our numbers are just pretty and it's exciting, as well as there are two white males sitting in the room, so everyone's calm. We had incredible luck and success with finding really phenomenal team members. For educators, it's an amazing job. Like, you know, most people prefer not to have basketballs flying over there into their head and like work from Bali and only teach 14 students. So that's really nice. And so they're kind of the quality of educators that we've been getting is unbelievable.
To the funding piece. So okay, it was difficult, but like what did you do to come over that gap? Dive a bit more into that, because this is so typical for all the founders, right? So you mentioned a couple of things.
If you're a solo female founder, get boys in the room and make sure they're white.
Wow, that's a hard truth, right?
But like, jokes aside, I mean, first of all, get your business in line. I think it's really important that, I mean, we can have goals and ideas and that's very nice, but we, you know, proof is in the pudding.
So you mean like actual metrics and actual...
Proof is in the pudding. Like, what are the educational metrics? Like, what are your bank? Like, what are the numbers? What's level of satisfaction of your customers, of your team, of the students themselves? Like proof is in the pudding. Like, you have the difficulty, of course, is like when you start, you don't have anything. You have to make sure that you need to sell something you don't have. And so you can sell a dream that could be easier for some and harder for others. You can sell a team. And that's kind of it. And I think entrepreneurship that strong has one or the other. So either you have a strong enough network or enough financial resources to put things off the ground on your own with whatever it takes. And then start when you have something to actually sell, you can start going around and chopping it. That's a one option. Or you like eat dirt for like 4 years. And hopefully you also have that. Hopefully you have the ability to do both.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think there are a lot of lies around like founding, you know, you just started from nothing. It's like, no, you didn't. You're a millionaire dad. Like, what are you talking about, right? You know, people have hero stories about entrepreneurs, but the reality is, like, it doesn't work like that. The meritocracy is not how, at least from the way I see the world, it's not how it actually works. Networks are important. Your ability to connect and to charm is important. Hopefully, I think I have incredible luck with the only talent I'm quite sure I have, which is if there's anyone in the world I want to talk to, I'll get to them. And then like, okay, it's up to me to convince them, but to get to them, I can. And I think that's a good talent to have. Look, I mean, in the end of the day, like the funds that I wanted to back us up did, right? But I think there is a lot there are a lot in the gaps. I mean, ideally, if you are not a resource heavy type of business, I think people should make sure that their business just doesn't need funding. And if it comes, that's really nice. But I mean, make sure that you can stand on your own feet as quickly as you possibly can.
And we'll dive into that in a second. Just moving to sort of the future outlook. So If you look forwards in the next 6 to 12 months, what's keeping you up at night?
I sleep very well because I need to be wake up and be focused. So yeah. I make sure I sleep.
Good. First advice. Yes.
Sleep. Yeah, I mean, like, don't be a tired wreck because no one's going to want to do anything with you. That's kind of like, just don't do it. But the things that, you know, top of mind, right? On team, we're adding some key hires now. And as I mentioned before, like, no mistakes are allowed to be made here. So that's the first. We're opening 2 new geos. And that requires high focus and high sensitivity to details. I'm very much looking forward to the learning, and I hope it's not too painful. And then I think an ability to maintain emotional cohesiveness and safeness for the team in a way that it remains an amazing place to work in, and the collaboration is incredibly high, and people come up and talk about tensions and problems, so we know what to solve, making sure that as we grow, we can maintain truth-telling culture is top of mind for me. New people, deliberate growth, truth-telling culture, and obviously, like, super happy kids and family.
Yes, of course, of course.
That learn and do amazingly well. And like,
you've already shared a lot of advice, but is there anything, I would say, else that you would share to other EdTech founders that are, you know, just starting up based on your experience?
I have several. One is, if you don't absolutely have to do it, don't.
Ooh. Okay. In what sense?
Every sense. It's like not a pleasant experience. It's not. If you have any other option, do the other option.
I will put that as the tagline of this podcast.
Like, the world doesn't need more stuff unless they're absolutely necessary. Your life doesn't need entrepreneurship unless it's absolutely necessary. Like, maintain your friends, go party, have close family relationships, get a salary that's real nice. Don't underestimate these things.
But you're also alluding to sort of, you know, solve a proper pain point. Is that also what you mean in addition to sort of your personal self?
Yeah, like, build things that the world absolutely needs, and that you are the absolute person to build. Like, if in any other way, please don't do it. Just like Nike, but the opposite. Just don't do it. Just don't. That's a first.
Yeah. That's a good one.
The second is, I mean, your job is to make sure that the best people are solving the problems to be solved. And if you do your job well, you're the dumbest person in the room. It is incredibly hard at the start because no one wants to work for, like, no money and, like, an idea and insecurity. And so you'll have to understand and recognize what are your levers and how do you get those people. And that's hard. But I think that's a main focus. Don't spend your time with time wasters. If you come to a meeting and you have this little in the bottom of your belly saying, what am I getting yet from this conversation? Get up and leave. Time is the only thing you actually have. So be very stingy about it and be incredibly picky with what you do with it. And work only with people you actually enjoy. Like, you're going to meet them all the time. Just don't include unpleasant human beings in your anything, even if they are they have the titles or they have the power or they have all the things. This is another thing nobody talks about. Like sometimes you just don't have another option. And if that's the case, well, sorry for you. And I can say sorry for me too, right? Like I've had to do a lot of things. I wish I didn't, but like just, you know, part of the eating sand experience. That's, but really try and be, if you can pick, then like prioritize just great human. And the last one, maybe if you want another, meet and talk to the customers and listen to them. And not only customers, whatever, kids and your team, try and like, don't build companies like old school. We're not building armies. We're building collaborative spaces. Just don't do the hierarchy thing. It's weird. Talk to people and make sure that they feel safe enough to tell you the truth.
I will let that be the final word and really great words of wisdom. And it's a good list for our fellow EdTech founders all across the world. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It has been a pleasure, and definitely we can talk more as Bina evolves, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what's next for you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. If any of the people listening need help and they think I'm the person to help them, they can and should ping me. I'm a human being, and I like talking to smart humans, so do that.
We'll do that.
And if you want to join our, and if you want to join our team, also ping us.
Ah, yes, of course, of course. Anywhere in the world. Have a lovely rest of the week.
Thank you so much. See you later.
See you. Thanks for listening to the EdTech Founders podcast from EdTech Garage. Find further episodes and more about the EdTech Garage Network on edtechgarage.org.